Thank you very much. Thanks for coming with such a short notice.
Time is the last meeting.
So today I want to tell you something about this story that has been going on for a while about the valid representation of conformal correlation functions. But in particular, I want to give you an update on our last work in this paper with BMP, Patrick, Jared Kapler, Subrat Raju, and Paul Andrew. And let me start right away by just making your picture of the usual motivation that I've kind of emphasized several times here already. So, the intuitive idea behind this work is that follows from the fact that ADS is basically the perfect laboratory to study quantum gravity. ADS is a box where we can do experiments. We live here outside, we have a perfect time, some unchanged, some absolute time, which is ADS global time here in the boundary. And then inside, there's gravity. Okay? But we can probe it from outside without being affected by it. So we can prepare some sources, send in some excitations, some gravitons, or some other fields. Some scattering process can occur here in the middle. And then we can observe some detector. We can actually observe what's going on inside. Yes. Okay. So if you're thinking along these lines, you're basically arrived at the conclusion that that this ADS scattering amplitudes, not in a precise sense, in a moral sense, this picture that we're seeing here, are nothing else than the dual CFG correlation functions. Okay? So this is the analogy that I've been trying to explore. And the problem is that in the usual language, this thing looks very different. The CFG correlation function looks very different than this guy. So what I want to tell you today is to tell you about the language where this analogy becomes transparent. Okay? And that's the language of Mellin amplitudes. And it's essentially, so it was proposed by Mark in 2009 as a way of rewriting CFT correlation functions. So let me just give you the precise definition. So consider a correlation function of scalar primary operators, okay? And let's, for simplicity, let's be Euclidean, so these points will be RD. Okay. So then the proposal is to rewrite this correlation function as some integral transform. So essentially, you have some integral over some integration variable that was defined, but then all the dependence on the points, the distances between the points, is encoded in this expression, and you integrate over these powers. So you have some gamma functions here that are convenient to introduce, and then this is the Mellin amplitude. It's this function. So you just do a write the correlator in this form, and that's the definition.
So delta ij is delta I minus delta j?
No, delta ij are integration variables. They have two indices.
Okay.
X ij is x I minus x j. So let me, I should tell you more, a bit more detail. So each one of these integrals is done from minus I infinity to I infinity, so
parallel to the imaginary axis, looks like a not in Barnes, but like integral. And moreover, there's constraints. So not all the delta i's are really integration variables that are independent. So actually, there's a constraint. If you sum the delta i's, say over j, you fix I, you must get delta I. So the constraint follows from the fact that at point xi, you have an operator of dimensions delta I. So for this to transform as a primary at point xi, you actually need this all the powers here that have an I to sum to delta I. Okay. So from this constraint,
sorry, I'm confused.
You sum
pure imaginary things and you get real, right? You said that all data
is a pure
imaginary.
So here, this, it's a bit...
Oh, there is real part.
Some gamma here.
There is real part,
yeah.
Okay.
It's just parallel to the imaginary. Okay. So just some quick counting. So just from there, it's symmetric, but doesn't exist ii, right? Because there's no xi minus xi 0. So that would be the number. But now you have here n constraints. So you have n minus 3 over 2 integration variables. Okay. Which is precisely the number of cross ratios also in an endpoint. So essentially, what this does is just a transform. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's like a Fourier transform in the law of the cross ratios. Okay, so this definition. So now, why is it interesting? So this is interesting because Mark noticed that now if you want to solve these constraints, one natural thing to do is to introduce some artificial momenta. Let's call it pi, so one momenta for each particle, such that pi squared or minus pi squared is delta I. So you can think of this as some kind of on-shell condition. And also that the sum of pi is equal to zero. Okay? Some kind of momentum conservation. So then if you choose pi like that, and then you define, or if you write delta ij as pi dot pj, you automatically solve the constraints. So now, really, the analogy is when you think of this Mellin amplitude here as a function of the Mandelson invariance. Okay. I'll put in quotes because this momenta are artificial. I mean, they're not. They don't have an intrinsic meaning. They were just introduced so that their dot product is equal to this delta j. I didn't even have to tell you in how many space-time dimensions do they have to leave. Okay, we'll see. This is like a trick that will tell us everything about the singularity structure of the Mellin amplitude. But these momenta by themselves, so far, don't have a direct physical meaning. Okay. But we will see that afterwards. So let me just tell you that you should think. So I can define Mandelson invariance just by the usual definition. And you see, if you expand this square, you just get delta I plus delta j minus 2 delta j. Okay. So this is just some shifted version of the original integration variable. But it's actually very useful. Okay, so this is the definition. So now I want to tell you, I want to start to give you some some evidence, some why is this used? Basically, that's what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk, is convince you that this is a useful rewriting. So the first thing that one should consider is your B. Okay? So what does the fact that this correlation function is an operator plus expansion structure tells us about this Mellin algorithm? Okay? So let's consider, for example, the case where the point x2, let's look like that. So let's do x2 goes to x1, and x1 goes to the origin. So the OBE here tells us that we will have the let me write it first just for scalar operator for simplicity and so you'll just have the dimensions of the operator that you hear, and then okay, you'll have plus descendants here. And okay, if the operator of spin is slightly more complicated, but you can also do it. So now you see, when we take this limit, we see that the expansion here of this correlation function, now if you put this OP inside the correlation function, this just tells us that the just has pure power. Okay? This correlation function in this limit of x2 into x1 is just pure powers of this distance x1 magnitude. So now let's look at what this formula tells us. So let's look at the four-point function. It's not even important. It's more operators. So what you will get here is let's be more complete. So 3 of x3, or 4 of x4. And now let's look at this formula. As I told you before, you have same n equals 4, you have two independent variables. So let's choose this integration values to be delta 1, 2, and delta 1, 3, for example. We are free to choose two of them as the integration variables, the other ones are fixed using the constraint. And now you have here this Mellin amplitude that you can write as a function of these two independent variables. And now let's specialize all these product factors. We want to consider the limit when x2 goes to x1. So this, we have this x to the minus 2 delta 1, 2, gamma of delta 1, 2. And then we have all the other factors, gamma of delta ij's and xij's minus delta ij, which do not are not singular in this limit. The only one that is singular is x1, x2. This is ij different from 1, 2. So now I see how this reproduces the expectation from UP. You see that you have to do this integral in the complex plane of delta 1, 2. You have to do this integral parallel to the imaginary axis. And so for that, we have here a gamma function that tells us that you have holes in the negative integer. And this one you don't know with the generic function. And you have to do an integral, say, along this contour. Okay. But now you see, we want the limit of x going to 0. So x going to 0 means that we want to deform the contour to the left. Because then as we pick more and more negative powers of delta 1, 2, like by picking the poles when we deform the contour, we just recover a Taylor expansion in x, or powers, or expansion in x. So you see very clearly what happens. Like if you want to match this kind of contour integration with this OPE structure,
What you need is, for each power that appears here in your P, you need a pole, you need a simple pole. In the either from this gamma function or from this Smellian angle. Okay. So, and there is nothing else that can appear in this in terms of analytic structure, because if you have double poles, then you see when a double pole, you will have to take a derivative here, so you will get a log of x, okay? Which is not it is not compatible with your Lie structure. So whenever you have just a discrete spectrum of dimensions, then the M, this Mellin amplitude, only has single poles. It's a meromorphic function. So this is the first important conclusion. The second thing okay, so another thing that you can already notice here is that why is it convenient to pull out this gamma function? But if you see, saying that this gamma function has poles at negative integers, corresponding to saying that you have a primary here, so delta 1, 2, a pole at delta 1, 2 equals minus m, corresponds to having delta p equals delta 1 plus delta 2 plus 2m. And you see, if you are used to this story of the CFT, this is nothing else than the dimension of the double trace operator. So this is the operator, if you want, like O1 with the derivatives O2, okay? With m derivatives. This is the double trace operator. So actually, the gamma functions, what they are doing is automatically dealing with the contributions to the OPE of double trace operators. So the Mellin amplitude, the poles of the Mellin amplitude, only come from single trace operators.
So why is this a double trace?
By double trace, I mean,
I can take a trace over the whole scene.
I was abused of language. So what I'm saying is that double trace is the appropriate language when each one of these O's is a single trace operator. It's trace of something. Okay.
Oh, it's already a trace of something.
Yeah, it's already. So then it's okay. But okay, more generally, this will be relevant whenever you have some kind of perturbative expansion. That's the product of two operators as a dimension, which is almost the sum of your initial one plus some small correction. And the small correction will be expanded. I'm thinking in the context where O is trace of some fundamental fields, and then that will be a double.
But this should apply to a field where that's not true.
So in the Ising model, I would say that pulling out this gamma function is a bit artificial. Because since you actually don't have these operators, you actually will need zeros here to cancel these poles. So this definition is not... to be honest, we haven't explored these Mellin amplitudes in cases where you don't have this large n expand. We only looked at large n, like with a couple of ADS here. But in other cases, we expect these gammas not to be so useful. This is the... So this was basically just the. I wanted to give you the intuitive reason why this was. Why this was. It worked like this, but actually, Mark study the haze in detail, and even if the operator has spin, the singularity structure is very simple. So it's easier to give the position of the pole in terms of this variable. So it's just, okay, I'll put the P, minus L. So the position of the pole is given by the dimension minus the spin of the operator that appears in your PE, plus some this 2m, where m is some integer that runs from 0 to infinity. And moreover, something that I didn't emphasize here, but it's actually clear if you also, actually doing right here, you should complain. I mean, there's an OP coefficient here, right? C1, 2, T. And so if you actually replace the OP coefficient and try to analyze what's the coefficient associated with this power, you see that it's just related by, to the product of the OP coefficient. So it's not surprising that the residue of the Mellin is given by the product of the OP coefficients. So this for the formal part. So, but then there's a, for the scalar case it would be that whenever you have spin, there's actually a polynomial in the residue. So that depends on L and M, and it's a polynomial in the other independent variable, okay? Which you can choose to be S1, T, for example. So, maybe this is. So now I'm writing the general case of, like, for a four-point function, the singularity structure of the Mellin amplitude is always of this form. You will have poles associated with operators that appear in your PE, and the position is fixed by the dimension and spin. See that it's like the operator going on shell. Remember that on shell means S squared equals delta. S equals delta. And the residue is a polynomial in the other independent variable. Right? So S12 is fixed at the pole, but there's still another independent variable, and it's a polynomial of the big L. And these polynomials are known, are fixed by kinematics. They're not, there's no dynamical information in that.
Is L, is it a spin of the operator, or is it the spin of the particle exchange?
What do you mean particle? Here I'm just talking about CFT. It's
okay, so
the
spin of the operator.
Yes. Good. So this is what I want to emphasize. In the general case, M only has simple poles. The residues of the poles factorize following from UP in this form. And moreover, if you have a theory with a larger expansion, then these gamma functions help you split multi-trace operators from single-trace operators, so that the Mellin amplitude only has poles associated with single-trace. Okay. So this is like the general properties that starts to make this language interesting. Okay, so now I want to specialize to calculations from ADS. Okay? So let's look at the three-level Witten diagrams in ADS. Three-level Witten diagrams. So, and let's consider, so this is your ADS, Euclidean ADS. Okay? And let's just consider correlation functions of the scalar primary operator. Okay, so you'll have usual rules of Witten diagram, you have both boundary propagators, then you'll have some interactions. Generic can be a cubic vertices, you can also have like quartic vertices. But it's just everything is scalar operators and just some endpoint and particle vertices. Okay. This is the set of diagrams that I want to study. So the first thing that we were able to understand is So here, this factorization of the pools was for the 4-point function. So here, let's try to understand factorization in this more general n-point function case, but restricted to this weakened diagram. So, okay, I basically have to just tell you how the result, how it works. So suppose you have particles here from 1 to k, here k plus 1 up to n particles. And now let's focus on this propagator here. Let's say the propagator here is a scalar propagator of dimension delta, okay, associated with a field whose mass is delta minus d, right? So now what happens is that the Mallet amplitude associated with this diagram has a pole associated with this propagation. Sorry?
How do you fix an ordering?
I mean, I'm just drawing one diagram and labeling the external legs. I'm not summing over diagrams or anything. It's just diagram by diagram. I mean, these numbers are just so that I can write formulas here. There's no meaning to the ordering. So. Okay, I'll tell you the result, and you will believe it because it's so natural. So, what happens is that this function, this Mallet amplitude associated with this diagram, has poles at the variable m has poles at minus p1 plus pk squared. What is this variable? Again, you just use the rules. You expand the square, so it's just a sum of delta I up to k minus q sum of delta I j up to k. And let's pause in this variable, okay, precisely at the value delta plus 2m, where m is, again, this integers, the series of poles that runs all the way to infinity. So you see, it's exactly what we would expect, like, from the internal propagator going on shell. And moreover, the residue factorizes into left and right correlated, okay? So if you break it here, we call this left and right, the residue at this pole is basically just, so I'll write the simplest case then. So for m equals 0 for the first pole, it's just that. It's really just the product, where m left is this part of the diagram where the last point here is, as I mentioned, delta, but gets connected to the boundary, okay? So, let me, I know, something like that, and then this point is connected to the boundary. This would be M left. So it's exactly like in flat space. You have poles associated with internal propagators going on shells, and the residues of that pole factorizing to left and right. So for the other poles, so the ones that are associated with non-zero m, it's slightly more complicated, but it also factorizes and is completely determined by the right and left. So the expression here is a bit more complicated. So what it is, so you have to sum over some integers. Let me call these integers nij, so integer, one integer for each variable delta ij, and then you sum m left shifted times some known factor, so delta ij over nij
nij factorial. So you sum all these nij's from zero. You sum these nij's with the constraint that they sum to m. And this symbol here.
And they are positive.
Yeah, and they are positive. So this is just the Pockhammer symbol. It appears a lot of times here. So it's just factorial. Just two gamma functions. So okay, expression becomes more complicated because so essentially, morally everything is the same as in flat space. You have poles associated with the propagated Gongon shell and factorization in lower point amplitudes. But you have, instead of one pole per propagator, you have a series of poles given by this integer here. And then as you go up in these integers, the radius are still fully determined by the lower point amplitudes, left and right. But the expressions become more involved. I mean, gamma functions start to proliferate first. Good.
You have to integrate on this extra point.
Which point? So all these points are being integrated over, right? This is the boundary points are fixed, but the bulk points are being integrated over.
The new one.
No, the one on the right. This one? No, this one is not integrated over. I mean.
But then how do you choose?
Sorry, actually I should put more labels here. So here, this was a n-point function. So the left is a k plus 1 Malin amplitude, right? So the k legs plus 1 that came from here. And this one is n minus k plus 1.
Then this new point was not some information you had before.
You compute the Malin amplitude, not the amplitude, right? Like with the Fourier transform. Function of delta is not a fixed.
So this M doesn't have a pole of back to boundary propagator. It only has a lot in the back.
Yes, it only has poles associated with the internal propagators. So actually, let me now give you. Let me now give you the final rule for this diagram, which makes that even more obvious. So by final rules, I mean, can we get direct rules to compute this Malin amplitude just by looking at the diagram and writing down the expression? I mean, we have final rules to compute a Witten diagram in position space, right? Is it connect both to boundary propagator, both propagators integrate over AVS? But now it's like, can we get like momentum space Feynman rules? Feynman rules for the Malin amplitude. And okay, and the answer is yes, at least for this class of diagrams. We still don't know the complete general case, but for three-level scalar diagrams, it's the following. So first of all, as we saw over there, there's a notion of momentum conservation at each vertex. What do I mean by that? I just mean that you have this momenta p. Say p1 associated with external legs, p2, and then you can associate momenta with internal legs just by following momenta, right? Here will be p1 plus p2, and here it is plus pk, and p1 plus p2 plus pk. Okay? Although, again, I repeat, this momenta is some artificial labels, but there is this rule that you can assign momenta to each flat, to each propagator. So then, what are the rules? So for each propagator, and Natalia has already only internal, there's no
there's no contribution from the Boltzmann bounder propagator, so this Malling amplitude is like an amputated amplitude. For this propagator, so a propagator is associated with momenta by this rule, and it's also associated with two labels. Delta, which is the dimension of the field that is propagating here, and this integer, m, which is already presented there. So,
that's also just described.
No, that's at the pole. So let me write this first. So you have here a momenta, which is some sum of pi squared, the correct momenta that is flowing here in the vertex, and then the sum plus delta plus 2m. So this denominator is the one that has to pull when it goes on shell. And then there's some numerator, okay? And, I can write it. Like 1 plus delta, I'm going to do 2 over n factor. It's some explicit factor, it's not that important. So what's really important is that all the dependence on the delta j, on the variables, the Mendel sum invariants, comes from these propagators. Okay? When you expand this and you write a different delta j. And then you have the vertices. Okay, now the vertices have how many labels do the vertices have? So suppose you have a vertex, some say lambda n phi n. So you have to know which operator each leg has a dimension associated, and also one of the integers. So like delta 1 and 1. Okay. So all, right. For each leg you have to tell what's the dimension of the field that's coming in and what's the integer associated with this propagator. And given that, there's an explicit formula for the that depends on these delta i's and their max. So I can give it to you. I mean, it's just some sums of a gamma function or all kinds of something explicit. And actually, for the generator, I should give the reference. We studied more cubic interaction. Actually, Miguel Paolo, you did cubic and also partly, but Miguel Paolo was the one that understood how I'll generalize this to endpoint functions and gave its explicit expression. That's also from July. But the important point is that here there's no dependence on the kinematics. Okay? All the dependence on the momenta, on the delta it is, goes from the propagator. And then the final step is just sum over these integers, mi from 0 all the way to infinity. Okay. So you see, as I said before, the difference with flat space is the fact that there's this integer. There's more than one pole. There's an infinite series of poles associated with each propagator instead of just one.
That's not very surprising.
That's not very surprising, because actually I forgot to mention that here, at the level of your PE, you see that this integer also appears, and it's associated with the descendant. So just to, this still looks a bit complicated. So it's interesting that in some examples, and actually in some relevant examples, this series truncates. Okay. So if you take delta equals 2, for example, which requires dimension less than 6 for unitarity, but if you take delta equals 2, then actually the only contribution comes from the m equals 0. So in this case, it's really propagators, just give propagator delta, just give 1 over p squared plus 2, which is delta plus 2. And vertices give some constant vertices, so proportional to, say, a couple constants on the end. So in this case, it's like as simple as flex case. And what's interesting is that, so this cancellation occurs essentially when delta is. I'm saying more general than what you said. Sorry. For phi cubed. So. Actually, it's not clear if this holds for all higher point interaction, but for phi cubed it's simple of that. Because you see, this cancellation occurs from zeros of this function when you take this particular power. But actually, what I wanted to say is that if you look at phi cubed here, you see it happens every time delta is a positive integer. So the same is true in ADS. If you want to consider massless fields in ADS 5, your dimension equals 4. And it's what we've seen from studying the Mellin-Lamp associated with Witten diagrams that actually follow from supergraph in ADS 5 is that they have rational Mellin-Lamp. So this infinite series of poles truncates in like 2 or 3 poles, which is a special dimension that they have. Okay, so actually, it's in a case very relevant, like AS5 process 5, it's even more simpler than this.
Is it just that hypergeometric functions for values of delta are rational functions?
No, if you look in position space, it's extremely complicated. Well, sorry. The image of this fact in position space is that amplitudes can be written as a finite sum of d functions. D functions, these special functions that are integrals over. A d function is contact diagram in ADS with some external, as a function of the external diagram. So if you can write diagrams as a finite sum of d functions, that means it has a rational Mellin. So yeah, that's the image. But these functions are still very complicated.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me give you the last argument why this is a good language. And that argument is the flat space limit. So actually I already talked about this here, so let me just quickly review what happened in this case. So basically now we have factorization, we have Feynman rules, so we have this identification of momenta and Mendelssohn invariant. So we seem to be in a language that really looks like a scattering amplitude. So the question is, does it help to take the flat space limit of ABS? So what do I mean by the flat space limit? I mean that if you have some, let's say, Witten diagram, some generic Witten diagram in ABS, and now you take the radius of ABS going to infinities, so essentially you zoom in ABS in some flat region, so you go to Minkowski space, and I'm drawing this picture of Minkowski space. So in Minkowski space, you can draw the same diagrams, but now instead of connecting it to bulk to boundary propagators, you connect to plane waves in the usual way of scattering amplitude. Okay. So is there a way of going from the Mellin amplitude associated with this Witten diagram, with this CFT correlation function to the S matrix, let's say the T S equals 1, to the T matrix here as a function of, say, the momenta or the invariance PI of TJ? Okay. This is the question. And actually, the answer is very simple. So Now that you are in these variables, it's actually very simple to map one thing to the other. So the first thing you have to understand is that if you want to take the flat space limit of ABS, what you want to do is consider a process where the energies involved are much higher than the ABS scale. Right? So you want to consider energies much bigger than the curvature of ABS. So then, now it's you see, energies in ADS are these dimensions of the operators, and we've seen that the position of that the dimensions of the operators just give you poles in these delta j's. So it's natural that what we really want to take this limit is delta j is much bigger than 1.
Okay.
So that's the limit. The limit corresponds to taking these variables B. Because you see, dimensions over there are energies in units of the ABS curve. That's why we are. So I'll just give you the formula.
Do you mean real part of delta G? Because delta G for your components, right?
I thought
only real part
has
anything to
do
with
energy. You see, it's a bit not very important because you see, in the end, I mean, you'll get something from this final rule, it's a completely analytic function.
No, you just answered the question, is it absolute value square? What do you mean by that? You write a complex number, much bigger than one. I'm trying to understand what does it mean. Do you mean absolute value?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yes, actually, so the ratios of delta i's are kept fixed. That gives like scattering angles, but the overall value has to work infinite. So like you scale them all with some big answer. So and in this limit, this Mellin amplitude is directly related to this scattering amplitude. So I'll just write a formula so that you see that it's very concrete. But take your scattering amplitude as a function of momenta, so it's a scalar scattering amplitude, so it's just a function of scalar products. Replace the scalar products by delta ij times this beta, just do one integral over beta, and you get the large delta ij behavior of the Mellin amplitude.
Okay.
So maybe I should comment just.
So if one is an n, it's
right, so in this limit, essentially this sum becomes let me comment. So say you take, for example, the simplest diagram where this M appears, right? Just one exchange like that. So first you can do two things. You can take the flat space limit in two ways. Either by keeping this dimension fixed and taking the flat space r to infinity. So you see, by doing that, you get a massless particle in flat space because the mass, right, the mass of this field, mass square is equal to delta minus d over r square. Okay. So if you do it that way, you get a massless particle in flat space, and actually all these poles. You have this series of poles labeled by this integer n, and actually when you see that from very far away, they just condense in a cut, and it's the cut so here in that case this is just say 1 over standard. Say, for example, S12, right? The scattering amplitude for this diagram, if this is particle 1 and 2, this is just 1 over S12, minus under. So the integral does nothing, right? The integral just changes the, I mean, you just get 1 over S12 times beta. So just changes, gives some gamma function. But the dependence in S12 is just 1 over S12. So what happens here is that each sum of each pole, this parameter is going to infinity, so we just pull it out, and there's some infinite sum here that just gives the residue of this pole over 1 over S12. So this is the simplest case. Then you can also take a limit where you recover a massive particle. And for that, you have to scale delta to infinity at the same time. And in that case, it's a bit more subtle. What happens is that this sum over m of discrete poles actually condenses in a cut. And the cut in this picture is just the cut that is produced by this integral when you have here a shift by some mass, by mass squared. Right? So now this integral over beta produces a cut. And this cut is nothing else than the continuum limit or this sum of the poles. But this can be really made very precisely, maximal factors. But actually, to get more intuition, it's better to think about simpler diagrams. So you take a contact interaction. Okay? If you take a contact interaction in flat space, the scattering amplitude is just a constant. And the Mellin amplitude is also just a constant. Okay? So you just, this integral is just a normalization. But now, if you put derivatives, okay, if you put derivatives in the vertex, then the scattering amplitude is just a polynomial in the Mendelsheim invariance, right? When you take derivatives, it's like contracting momentum, but there's no denominator. So again, the same fact goes through. Mellin amplitude for a diagram like this in ABS is just a polynomial in this Mendelsheim invariance. And what this formula does is matching the highest degree term in this polynomial. So highest degree term in the polynomial of the Mellin from the diagram, from a contact diagram in ABS, is the same polynomial that you get from putting the diagram in vice versa. And this integral basically what has to do is to fix the relative coefficients when you have something more complicated. It's not a polynomial. Okay, I have 5 minutes, so let me conclude by discussing like a big list of open questions that we have. So, do you have any questions?
So in the paper you and I wrote on string scattering.
Yes.
So there we also had an integral transform as
an example.
Exactly
the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. Right, because when we do, so the problem is when you want to recover, if there's no scale here, say if this is just some contact interaction, which is an overall coupling constant, then you don't need any integral. It's just take large delta j and you mass the scattering amplitude. But if you have some function here, some scattering amplitude, that has an intrinsic mass dimension, then you have this dimensionless parameter, which is how the comparison between the mass times this mass scale and the ABS scale. And this is the transformation that requires an integral. But it's only always one integral, even for an n point function. Yeah, I honestly I would like to have a more intuitive understanding of this integral, but it's a bit so far it has been just it works like that. I still don't see it as something very intuitive. Okay, open questions. The first thing is the obvious, right? This Feynman rules or this factorization, let's say the Feynman rules, look very natural, but we only need 3 levels. Can we do loops? At least the Feynman rules. And so far we're not successful. So you see, it's very natural to, if you have a loop, to again associate the same factors to each propagator. The hard part is to know how do you sum over the internal loop, or how do you integrate over the loop moment. It's not clear, and I think it again comes back to the obstacle that these momenta are really artificial. They don't have intrinsic meaning. So you want to integrate over dp, but we only know how to integrate over delta ij. So
is this used for even all measures? In the tool? I mean, what else? I don't know how many dimensions they have.
Yeah, we never integrate over dp. dp is something. P is only like a mnemonic that we use to remember where the rules are in the operator. The only, the variable that has the real meaning here is.
So can you go to the. Can you go to the higher dimensional space where the ADS is embedded as a hyperboloid and impose some delta function constraints? Did you try that?
But why do you? Okay. I mean, to compute this integral. I mean, to compute this diagram. I studied this diagram even for this flat space limit. This works. I mean, I have an expression for this diagram, but it's just coming from doing the usual position space with the final rules. The question is, can you rewrite this diagram as something natural, following from rules in space? And that I've not been able to rewrite. I know the answer for this diagram, I just don't know how to rewrite it in this language.
Any kind of loop delta ijs would you have?
That's a good question.
It's not obviously
one. No, it's not one. Yeah, that's actually let me give you another problem that you didn't complain, but people usually complain, and it's still something that it's not completely clear. So I told you that there are n(n-3/2). Independent integration variables. And that corresponds to cross ratios, also the number of cross ratios. But corresponds to the number of cross ratios, like this, if you just take the simple relations where you take products of cross ratios, I mean, you identify. But there's more relation between the cross ratios, because cross ratios are formed from points that live in d dimensions. So at most, there's n times d real numbers, real degrees of freedom in the problem. So when n is very large, clearly this is less than n-3/2. So there's nonlinear constraints between the cross ratios when you go high in n. And so what that means is that the representation I write for the correlation function is basically not unique. M, the Mellin number in general, is not unique if n is very large, because these xijs are not all independent. If you know the distance, if you know enough distances between points, you know all the other distances in the d-dimensional space, just by no more space to change the
point. Okay, so for you, the Mellin transform is not really invertible?
For high enough n, is not really invertible, yes. So that's another sign. Another way of saying this is that if you look at this definition of delta ij as pi dot pj, you see, pi dot pj, again, depending on the dimension where p lives, you can only solve this constraint, delta ij equals pi, or this expression, again, you have here more equations than the number of variables, right? If p, so the natural thing is for p to live in d plus one dimensions. It's natural because this is the dimension of ADS, and it's also natural because p satisfies the mass shell condition.
So since it's a mass shell, it reduces one dimension, and then you get P times N like that. So the counting between P's and X's works if P lives in deep open dimension. But you see, now again, you will have more. In general, if I just give you a set of delta j's, you won't be able to solve for P. It's the same, it's another phase of the problem.
But what about
last
case? Do you have similar formula for loop
amplitude? Yeah, this applies to. So I've checked this formula for this one loop diagram, for example. This in principle applies to.
But then, wouldn't it also suggest that you see in that bracket you identified PIPJ in flat space up to scale to delta IJ? So you again would like to do something like that, right? It's not a contradiction with.
No, so that means that you can only get M where delta IJ is in a smaller subspace, right? It's constrained because it's given from the top product. So you cannot get here delta IJs that do not solve these equations. So it is telling you that M does not actually live in all these N minus 3 over 2 delta IJs, and this space, this dimension of variables, it lives in a smaller space, in a more constrained space. That's what I physically it's telling us. But the way the equations work, I mean, we really, these finer rules that I give here are really when you write the correlation function with n and minus 3 over 2 integrals over delta j. So that's the stuff. For higher number of particles, you have this problem. Not resolved. Well, let me just make a few more comments, but I'm already over the time. So another very important thing is to study external operators with spin. So, okay, here I should refer to Miguel Paulus, because he started already with studies. We studied like 3-point functions of currents and 4-point functions of currents from ABS, and so he has some proposal of a generalization. But so you see, for the 4-point function, for example, it's very easy to, we know to, if you want to put here some graviton or some gauge boson, then we know how to do it. Internal particles, it's easy. It just changes. It's just this polynomial. These poles, instead of having a constant residue, they have some polynomial in the residue. But the question is, what if you want to make the external particles also currents or gravity? Then you need to redefine what you mean by Malle number, because you need to put indices in this Malle number. You have to go back to the first equation and change it. So Miguel Paulus has a proposal. Basically, he was studying all these bulk to boundary propagators of spinning particles, like of vector boson, can be written as some differential operators acting on the scalar bulk to boundary propagator. And so he brings out this differential operator that does that from the amplitude, and he calls the Malle number, which is the part that is being acted by this differential. And he found very promising expressions. So he found when he studied correlation functions of currents, what he was calling Malle amplitude was really very similar to what we have in flat space, the expression of the same particles in flat space. So that's work in progress, but something that's still not understood is really binary rules in general, or even factorization. You see? Factorization is really important that you understand internal and external, because when you factorize, internal becomes external. So that's not understood. And this would be like the first step to try to generalize BCFW, right? Because then we can try to see if
It's a problem deformation that allows you to compute the scattering amplitudes very efficiently. Also works for these Mellin amplitudes. Yes. Good. Just one more point, or two more points. So another thing that we've been thinking about is to try to study the bootstrap program in this language, in Mellin space. So instead of formulating in terms of position space correlators, does it help to change to this language and formulate it more in terms of this analytic properties of this Mellin amplitude? And so essentially you see, basically translates this bootstrap program for CFTs in terms of Mellin amplitudes, it's really very similar to this S matrix approach, bootstrapping the S matrix. Because you know you have to look for a Mellin amplitude that only has simple poles, so it's a very restricted analytic structure. Then so if you can say four operators the same, then this function is invariant under permutation of delta 1, 2, delta 1, 3, so it's crossing symmetric, it has to be manifestly crossing symmetric when you permute everything. That's why the way you write it is completely invariant. But then you see, if you look now at variable delta 1, 2, you have to see all these simple poles, the series of poles associated with operators that appear in loop E, and the residues are also fixed, they have to factorize in products of the coefficients. And if you look in the other channel, the same thing has to happen. Okay, so essentially, on the one channel you have poles in delta 1, 2 with residues polynomial in delta 1, 3, and then an infinite sum of that has to be rewritten as poles in delta 1, 3 with polynomial, with residues that are polynomial in delta 1, 3. So it's really not a problem for the duality, the exact duality in the sense of an exam, if you want to do two or more. So but what happens in practice is that these residues are these polynomials, and so far, I mean, so actually I should also cite Dolan and Osberg have a paper from 2 weeks ago or 1 month ago, I think, where they study conformal blocks in this Mellin space. So that's the way you get these polynomials explicitly. And they get some explicit expressions, some explicit recursion relations. But so far, it is not being very tractable, I think. The polynomials are polynomials that they depend on many parameters, these variables, so okay, it's work in progress. And okay, last comment is one thing that we should also explore, and actually Pedro is very interesting, and that is quick coupling. So far we mostly looked at strong coupling, right? A diagram, written diagram, yes. But what about weak coupling in large N gauge theories? So large N is still there, so you still have this single trace and double trace story. So, but you have many more single trace, right? Because then now there are really many more light operators, single trace operators. But still, really the question, and this is the particular question that Pedro is really interested, is if you can actually build higher point functions just from the knowledge of 2-point and 3-point of single trace operators. Because the OBE only tells you that you need to know all of the coefficients, including multi-trace operators. But in a large N-gauge theory, you see the Mellin amplitude, all the singularities, positions, and residues are fixed by only single trace data. So, up to questions about the behavior at infinity, it seems that we'll be able to derive the 4-point function, or even higher point function, just from single trace data. So that's something that's very interesting. Thank you, I should finish. Sorry for
questions.
Okay, if there are no questions, then let's send the speaker again.